Here's what happens when two best-selling writers get together for a little chat.
I just finished a novel about an old deacon in Brooklyn who pulls out his heater and shoots the worst drug dealer in the projects. It's another comedy. It's supposed to be funny.
Sounds hilarious.
That's John Grisham. He's best known for legal thrillers like The Firm and James McBride. He wrote The Color of Water. It won the Anisfield Wolf Book Award for nonfiction in 1997. He also plays a mean saxophone. In October of 2018, both authors got together at James Madison University for an intimate and laid-back discussion about their work.
If a person writes 30 books, how many books you've written?
40.
Sorry.
Up next, it's the John Grisham Writers Hour, featuring James McBride, produced by WMRA and James Madison University's College of Arts and Letters. From WMRA, this is the John Grisham Writers Hour. With millions of books sold and 40 novels under his belt, John Grisham is a criminal justice reform advocate, best known for legal thrillers like The Firm. He sat down with author James McBride, who wrote the award-winning memoir The Color of Water, along with historical novels like Miracle at St. Anna, which became a film directed by Spike Lee. Here's what went down when these two powerhouse authors got together for the John Grisham Writers Hour at James Madison University in October of 2018. John Grisham leads off the conversation.
Thank all y'all for being here. For 20 years, I refused to go on book tours. I just got tired of doing it, tired of signing books, and I'm pretty lazy anyway, and I just didn't want to travel around the country. And writers should tour if you can, if your publisher will pay for it. It's important for the business for writers to tour and meet the fans and say hello to people and say thanks and all that. And so I went to 20 cities last year, 20 bookstores, and everywhere I went, I would invite local writers to come to the store to do an event, to have a conversation. And I had a ball. I met 27 or 28 writers. We feel very lucky to have as our first guest James McBride. James is a writer, journalist, musician, songwriter, composer who is still the writer in residence at New York University. He is best known for his 1995 memoir, The Color of Water, which became an instant classic, the story of his background, his childhood, and a tribute to his white mother growing up in Brooklyn. Since then, he's written three historical novels, all exploring the complicated issues of race and tolerance and survival in America. He is a serious musician, composer, singer-writer. He plays a tenor sax. He's played with a lot of groups, toured all over the country. In 2016, President Obama awarded James the National Humanities Medal. In a ceremony at the White House, President Obama said, "James McBride has humanized the complexities of discussing race in America. Through writings about his own uniquely American story and his works of fiction informed by our shared history, his moving stories of love display the character of the American family." Please welcome James McBride. Welcome to Virginia.
Well, thank you very much.
Happy to have you here.
Well, nice to see so many nice people here.
So you just drove down from New Jersey?
Yeah, I drove down this morning, yeah.
You have never really left the metropolitan area, have you? Born in Brooklyn?
Yeah, born in Brooklyn. Stayed pretty much between New York and Philly most of my life.
Yeah.
Spent 2 years in Boston and maybe 2 years in D.C., close to it. But mostly in the New York area, you know. Most of my family's still there.
Yeah. So you haven't spent much time in Virginia, but it's a state that's very important to your story.
Yeah, well, my mother grew up in Suffolk. Mm-hmm. My mother was a Polish refugee whose family came to the States when she was two, and she was reared in Suffolk, Virginia. Her father was a Jewish rabbi who ran a grocery store in the black section of town, so I spent a lot of time in Suffolk when I was researching The Color of Water.
And I think your mother, at a young age in Suffolk, realized that she was rejected by the white kids because she was Jewish. And she felt more comfortable around the black kids, the ones who came to the store, the ones in the neighborhood?
Yeah, yeah. She, you know, in the South in the 30s when she was a child, the anti-Semitism was, you know, it was pretty strong. Signs and, you know, no Jews, no dogs, those kinds of signs. And, they, you know, it was a real thing, you know. And so Jews were not accepted in her community. They weren't allowed to. Her best friend was a Gentile, you know, and she couldn't go to, she couldn't even go to high school graduation because she wasn't allowed to walk into a, you know, a forbidden place like a
church. Was not allowed by her father or by the local customs?
By her father and by the way she was raised. Her father was a very strict and quote-unquote Orthodox Jew. So that was, it was quite an education doing the research to put together The Color of Water. It was really something that I didn't really know that much about, you know.
So when did she leave Suffolk?
She left when she was 18, the day after she graduated from high school.
She fled.
She fled, and she always hated the South because of her experience growing up in Suffolk.
And she didn't care for her father either, right?
No, he was a, her father was a rabbi and who was very abusive towards her.
You said he was a lousy rabbi.
Well, yeah, he wasn't. I mean, you know, you have to be careful when you use these terms because, you know, you say rabbi, what does that mean? In those days, Jewish synagogues in the States would sign a contract with a person, and that person would have to stay there for a year, and if he was good, they would sign another contract. Well, they traveled quite a bit before they got to Suffolk because he was a terrible rabbi, so no congregation wanted him around. But when they got down here to Suffolk, there weren't a lot of Jews who wanted to stick around down here. It was a difficult life. So he managed to stick around here long enough for her to finish high school. He was a predator, and he wasn't really a true rabbi in the sense of what a rabbi, a holy man is, in terms of the way he lived.
And he sexually abused her for a long time.
Well, she didn't talk about it a lot, but he was certainly sexually abusive towards her, yeah.
What about her mother?
Her mother had suffered from polio, and she was from a good family. And she was kind of pawned off to him because in those days, arranged marriages were part of European Jewish life. Because they both came from Europe. She just suffered. She suffered till she died. You know, she was very lonely. She was a very charismatic woman, and she was actually liked, admired greatly by most of their black customers because she was so kind. She was a very kind person. And people who understand suffering are often kind. So, but she died of some kind of stomach cancer. And when she died, my mother wasn't allowed to see. Once my mother left home and married my father, her family set shiva for her, which is a Jewish mourning ritual.
They never reconciled.
She never saw her mother again after she left home.
So your mother's 18, she flees to New York, and then what happens?
She hung around Harlem for a while. She was attracted to that life, and she was working for her aunt who had some kind of factory in the Bronx. And she almost got sucked into that life, but her aunt had an employee there who was a young violinist from North Carolina named Andrew McBride, and she ended up marrying him and starting a small Baptist church in Red Hook, Brooklyn that still exists today.
He was also a preacher?
Yeah, he became a minister. He went to, in those days they called it Bible school or Bible college, and there's still one living member who was still, she's 104 years old, was one of the last one who was actually at the beginning. I go see her almost every week.
So this Polish Jewish girl from Eastern Europe marries an African American Baptist preacher in Brooklyn.
Well, she wanted her son to write a book. So she...
And boy, did he! Yeah. She had to provide the material, right?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Well, she, you know,
then she had 8 kids in about 4 years, right?
She had 8 kids over the course of 13 years.
13 years, and you were number 8.
I was number 8.
And your father?
And my father died suddenly of cancer. Then she went back to her, in desperation, she went back to her family, her Jewish family for help, and they wouldn't help her.
You tell the story of when she was destitute, homeless, you guys were hungry, and she went to see her sister?
She went to see her aunt.
Aunt who slammed the door?
Yeah, aunt slammed the door in her face. Yeah. Well, you know, there's a postscript to that, which, you know, we've got to know many of our Jewish relatives, and we get along quite well now.
So, obviously, your mother converted to Christianity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When she married your father.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just a token conversion. It was the real deal, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was one of the old-fashioned, you know, those old-fashioned where they bring the bench up and you sit down. They call it the moaning bench, and you sit on the moaning bench. And, yeah, And she recalled the moment where she accepted Jesus into her life very clearly. You know, it wasn't the phony baloney stuff you see nowadays with the camera on and, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't.
Well, I do too, but we didn't use the moaning bench. I never heard of a moaning bench.
In that church, they brought a chair up, a bench,
yeah,
and you sat on it. Some people call it the moaning bench. Some people just call it, you know, some people didn't call it nothing. But you just came up and you stood there, and then they take you to the back room where the deacon, I don't know what the deacons do to you back there. But they, you know, and then they bring you back out.
When they baptize you?
Well, in my day, I don't know what she went through, but in my day, they took you back there, and then you had to go through like certain training. You had to go to Bible study,
yeah,
and then they baptized you later.
Okay.
You know?
And all 12 kids, the first 8 kids went through that, or all 12?
I don't know about the last 2, 3. Well, I wouldn't say they all went through that, but most of them did. Toward the later days, when we moved out to Queens, some of them went to Lutheran Church. They fell away from the Baptist Church, and well, Lutheran Church didn't demand as much. You know, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, you're out.
So. Yeah, we heard about churches like that when I was a Southern Baptist. We couldn't believe it, though.
I bet you couldn't.
Well, that, you know, that was what the Presbyterians and Lutherans did, but they weren't really Christians. Well, we couldn't get over with the black folks down south. Well, they come to church at 10 o'clock and go and go and go till, you know, about 1 when we're caving with hunger, and take a quick bite and then go on and on and go all Sunday night. I mean, that's not unusual.
But see, the music, you know, the music had a lot to do with that because, you know, you're going on, and then it stops, and then somebody's feeling, that's another 20 minutes right there. So.
Well, see, we didn't do that foolishness. There was no clapping, like, you know, it was.
Yeah, but some of that music's beautiful, though.
Can I read an excerpt from The Color of Water?
Sure, yeah.
I was what Mommy called a little kid, one of the 5 youngins, microscopic dots on the power grid of the household, thus fit to be tied, tortured, tickled, tormented, ignored, and commanded to suffer all sorts of indignities at the hands of the big kids, who didn't have to go to bed early, didn't believe in the tooth fairy, and were appointed denizens of power by Mommy, who, of course, wielded ultimate power. She was in charge.
Yeah, she was large and in charge. Yeah. Yeah, she was, you know, in her house. She only had to say, she'd say, pick up that bag, and 8 people would kneel down. There wasn't any discourse about, you know, I always thought she was very mean, you know, as a child, that she was very strict.
You were embarrassed by her. Because she was white.
Yeah, because she was white. She was the only white person around. And didn't care, which made it worse. You know, she rode a bicycle.
She would never admit to being white.
No, she wouldn't talk about it. She'd say, I'm light-skinned, and she'd change the subject.
I'm light-skinned.
Yeah, she didn't really like a whole lot of talk about race too much. She wasn't all hot and getting hot and bothered about that too much. You know, she'd just do good, that, you know. Of course they ain't gonna like you. Why should they like you? You know, look. You don't brush your teeth. How come they don't? You know, she would find ways to cleverly maneuver around the race issue to just focus on school. It was all about education and religion.
This was the 1950s, 40s,
60s. For me, it was the 60s. Yeah.
Were there other biracial children in your neighborhood?
Oh, no, man.
No, she was the only white person.
Well, you know, the range of color in black America ranges, you know, in my neighborhood ranged from very light, white-looking to very dark. So it wasn't, but there weren't any, I knew no one who had a white mother. I didn't meet anybody like that. I can't remember. Maybe in college I might have. Oh, there was a kid in high school. I was in a band that went to Europe. There was a kid in high school whose mother was white, but he grew up kind of on the white side of the track, so he acted more white, whatever that means.
Yeah, let's don't go there.
I liked him. He was a nice guy. We just had a different, you know.
Who was her second husband?
Her second husband was named Hunter Jordan, and he was a furnace fireman in the housing projects where we lived. He was a very good person, you know, and I loved him very much because he raised me. And he was from Richmond, Virginia. And he was a different type of man. He was a very firm man. He was a person who really had grown up with in hardship in Richmond and came up, worked at Campbell's Soup in Camden for years. And you know, his brothers were all, these were firm, they were hard men. They didn't talk much, but when they addressed you, they looked at you dead on, and there was always the business of they would take care of business if necessary. They weren't that way, but that's kind of how he was. He was a firm, very firm person.
And he chose not to live with the family.
Well, you had 12 kids. I mean, the guy was, you know, the guy married.
Well, four of them were his, though, okay?
Yeah, that's true. And you know, we never thought. I suppose we were happy that anybody would bother with us, you know. But our house was so chaotic, and he was such a man. He was such a well-ordered, neat person, and he had been a bachelor most of his life, and then he married this woman with all these kids. So he. What he ended up doing after he eventually had to move in with us because they sold his, he had two brownstones in Brooklyn. The city raised them both to make a middle class development, which never happened. But he ended up moving to Queens with us. But he had like a basement area that was his. It was all neat. It was nice. It was nice and tight and tidy. And you knew that when you walked in, you had to keep that nice. And he had a Victrola record player and all. But he was a good person. I mean, think about it. Who would marry someone with eight kids?
Yeah, and then have four more.
Well, he loved having, you know, all these kids. He was very proud of us. His brother, you know, I talked to his brother many years after The Color of Water came out, my Uncle Walton. I used to say to Hunter, man, you're crazy. What's the matter with you? Why are you marrying this woman? And he said, I had enough for a baseball team. That was, you know.
How about a football team?
Yeah.
And he would come on the weekends and bring sacks of groceries, and y'all were glad
to see
him?
He would come on the weekends with sacks of groceries. Wait for him, you know. Come and bring sacks of groceries and Ottoman's cupcakes. Never forgot that. And when I became a grown man, I wrote to Ottoman's and thanked them for their cupcakes. Of course, they, you know. But I still see them, and I still think of him when I see those cakes. And Wonder Bread, too, because the Wonder Bread factory was near his brownstone.
Well, on the subject of food, can I read this? My brothers and sisters were my best friends, but when it came to food, they were my enemies. There were so many of us, we were constantly hungry, scavenging for food in the empty refrigerator and cabinets. We would hide food from one another, squirreling away a precious grilled cheese or fried bologna sandwich, but the hiding places were known to all and foraged by all, and the precious commodity was usually discovered and devoured before it got cold. Entire plots were hatched around swiping food, complete with double-crossing, backstabbing, intrigue, outright robbery, and gobbled evidence.
You're listening to the John Grisham Writers Hour. Coming up after a short break, hear why James McBride's mother wasn't all that impressed with the book.
In my mother's world, if they don't make a movie about something, it ain't a great book.
This is the John Grisham Writers Hour from James Madison University's College of Arts and Letters and WMRA. James McBride, author of The Color of Water, is speaking with John Grisham, and the conversation continues about McBride's mother.
All 12 went to college.
Right.
Because she was determined for you to have the best education. She didn't care about money. She didn't care about clothes. Didn't care much about food. She cared about education and your religious faith.
Right. That was it. I mean, she didn't really want to hear, you know, there were no, I mean, if she was raising kids now, they might put her in jail, you know, because she was so adamant and so strict in terms of, like, we weren't allowed to stay out after dark ever. And we weren't allowed to bring friends into the house ever. And we were not supposed to tell our business to people ever. So if people ask you, teachers would ask you, you know, where does your mother work? I don't know. Where does your father work? I don't know. And you were drilled until mommy showed up, and then the teacher would say, is James adopted? And then she'd get really mad. But, you know, you weren't allowed to. It was a really strict way that she raised us to think, because we were taught not to trust outsiders, because we were taught to believe that they didn't like us. They would hurt us some kind of way. And she created this sort of it's us against the world kind of thing, where, you know, there's nobody that's going to care for you other than your family and God. So you go to school and you do the work, and I don't care what Henry does, what Johnny does, what Sally does. Don't even tell me about it, because it doesn't matter. Only matters what you do.
What was her life like in her later years.
She had to adjust to being a widow when she was, I think she was 56 or something like that when she became a widow. And we lost the house in Queens. We couldn't afford to keep it. So she had to move to Philly, to Germantown section of Philly, which is a quote-unquote working class section. It's not really working. I mean, Germantown is pretty lousy. I mean, it's a beautiful area. It's really wonderful if you're a young couple trying to get started. But for her, she bought it. She bought the house for $11,000 when I was a freshman at Oberlin. By then, we were able to, my older brothers and sisters were able to support her. She had Social Security. And then when I got out of school, I started working. And, you know, she just managed. I mean, she had some difficulties. She got her purse snatched 2 or 3 times, I think. You know, she had an open heart surgery because she had a, you know, some concussion. But then she went to Temple when she was 60. She graduated from Temple at 65. She went back to school when she was, I think she was 60. And she graduated from Temple when she was 65. And listen to this. I had a friend who went to Temple, and she said they had a test. And she said, I saw your mother stand out in front of the classroom trying to ask people what to write on the test. She was cheating. And a couple of those papers, now that it's over in Temple University, God bless Temple, you know, I helped them to help with a couple of those papers. But, you know, she got a college degree. She was very proud of
it. What's she major in?
Social work. And she actually worked as a social worker for a few years before she retired.
So when you started talking about writing this book, what was her reaction to it?
Oh, she wasn't. You know, she wasn't crazy about the idea. Like, why are you going to go back there? So, you know, they're all dead. I'm dead to them, you know. And
so she didn't cooperate?
Not at first. No, I was persistent. Because what happened was I wrote a story. There was a Mother's Day coming up, and I had just started at the Boston Globe. And I was talking to an editor there named Alan. I can't remember his last name. And I just mentioned, I said, yo, my mother's Jewish. And he said, well, how long did you know that? I said, well, I saw it on my passport application. And he started asking me questions. That's a great story. Why don't you write it? So I went back home and I said, I want to write this story for Mother's Day. And she said, oh, no. And she said a few things. And so I did some research around it, and I wrote it anyway. And the Philadelphia Inquirer published it simultaneously. And that started it, and that was in 1981 or 82. Now, it took about, the Color of Water came out in 1995.
15
years
later.
It took that long for her to really, and for me to pull it together, and for her to you know, square with me about what happened in her young life. Because it was extraordinarily painful for her.
Did she eventually cooperate?
Eventually, to a point. I mean, it was hard for her to talk about being sexually molested by her father. Actually, she didn't say it. You know, she just wrote the words on a piece of paper and held it up to me like that. You know, she didn't. It was hard for her, and she was really extremely guilty about leaving her younger sister behind. She had 2 siblings. She had a brother who was killed in World War II, who left home when he was 15 and never came back, and he died in the Army in World War II. He was killed in action, and then she had a younger sister. When she ran off at 18, she abandoned her sister. And she felt tremendous guilt about that. And that guilt lasted the rest of her life. She ended up meeting her sister after the book came out. But she had tremendous guilt about abandoning her sister. And I don't think, if there was one thing she did not get over, was leaving her mother and her sister. Her mother, it took her a long, she came to Christianity after losing her mother. She felt that, you know, she felt God had saved her, redeemed her, and given her a second chance, that Jesus had reborn her for the sin of leaving her mother. But she could never quite get over the guilt of leaving her sister behind. So that was something that she just, you know, she bore with, you know, I think a degree of dignity. She never complained about her sister and her met in later years. They were not close, but she had a cousin in California that she grew close to. But she had enormous respect and love for her sister. And I think vice versa, even though her sister was a harder person, she was a hard woman. And she was a hard woman because she had a hard life.
Yeah. So the book came out in 95. It was an instant bestseller and a classic. It's still, I read it probably 2 years after it came out, about 20 years ago. It's still being taught today, and it's still a very famous book. Did she ever take any pride in it?
In my mother's world, if they don't make a movie about something, it ain't a great book. So I mean, she was happy. It's more like my son, the writer, than actually, you know, pride in what she had done as a mother. Honestly, didn't feel like she'd done a great thing. She said, "I love my children." I mean, mothers love to, you know, she would point out this lady up the street. She had 20 kids, and she, you know, I forgot the lady's name, and I would be like, "Well, yeah, but seven of them are in jail," and said, you know. But she, you know, she didn't feel she'd done anything great. She felt she just did what any mother who loves her children would do. And the proof is, you know, the proof is today, where you have all kinds of mothers raising all kinds of children. And some of the slights that some of the mothers that go through today with their children are nothing compared to what my mother went through. She didn't bother with it. She used to say, "I never get tired of the miracle of watching y'all grow up." That was really just like food for her.
What was the reaction from your siblings when the book became popular?
Most of them were very proud of it. I mean, they're private people, so, and their memories are different than mine. I mean, they were all, you know, the broad brush part of it, mommy not talking about being Jewish, and, you know. I had, like, once that said, "Why did you say I was fat?" You know, and I'm like... I mean, you know, look, my sisters, they have helped me. My sisters hold it down, so... But, you know, big or small, I love them very much, so...
Being recorded, by the way.
Yeah, I know. That's right. And I would like to eat at Thanksgiving one more time before I die. You know? So, I mean, my brother Billy was really proud of it. My brother Billy, who passed away, he was a doctor. He went to Yale. He was a wonderful cat. And of all my siblings, he supported his mother the most. And Billy was very much, very proud of his Jewish part as well. He found that to be... You know, it helped him. It worked for him, and you know, when he graduated from college, he sent his mother a check every single month until he died, until the week he died, every single month. So his death, because he predeceased her, was very difficult for her. That was a tough piece of business for her.
So where were you working when the book came out?
I was a musician. I was a saxophonist and. I think I was playing in a little Jimmy Scott's band.
Were you through with journalism?
Yeah. I quit journalism in about, I'd say, the late 80s, maybe. My last job was at the Washington Post. And I quit and moved back to Brooklyn, moved to Fort Greene. And then I wrote songs and played, you know, worked in musical theater and toured as a saxophonist with various people and wrote, you know, I wrote songs for Anita Baker, Grover Washington Jr., like that. And during that time, I wrote The Color of Water.
Okay, I was going to ask you about that. You said that you wrote most of this book on the road.
Yeah, because I was...
But you were touring?
Yeah, I was touring with, you know, every, you know...
How do you write on the road?
Well, see, when you get to a place, you know, when you get to a city, you got to do a sound check. You know, typically you're driving all night or something like that, or you know, it's... I mean, I wasn't playing with the Rolling Stones, so you roll into town, you're playing at some place, you know, maybe doing two nights or something, and you have to do a sound check. So you do a sound check, and then everyone breaks to eat. And so, you know, you do the sound check at maybe 11 in the morning or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and you break to eat, and then you go back to the hotel room, and then the guy you're sharing the room with, he cuts out chasing some young lady around or something, and then, you know, you put it together, and then you do the gig. Then you come back from the gig at 2 in the morning. You're wired now. You're not even screaming your name. And then you write a letter to somebody. And then when you get home, because you don't stay out for, you know, 6 weeks at a time. You stay out for, you know, you go out for 4 days. You go back. So, you know, I did lots of that. I'd play Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night. And I had Monday and Tuesday off. And sometimes I had a little job teaching English as a second language to Polish refugees in Williamsburg. I just put it together, you know. I can write anywhere. I'm one of those people, I can write anywhere.
I was going to ask you, how do you do it now?
Well, I get up at 4:30 and usually write between 4:30 and 7, and I get my son off to school. Then I come back home and maybe I go swimming or do a little exercise, and I take a little nap-a-poo, and then I write a little more, and then it's over, you know.
Always same. Always at home, same place, same.
No, well, I mean, it depends. If I'm on the road, I can write it. You know, I mean, I can't look at the beautiful. I'm not one of those who needs this, you know, the Palm Beach. I can't do that. I need quiet. You know, just a box with no. Holiday Inns are good. Holiday Inns. You know. I mean, because I don't like to write. I mean, it's too hard. You know, it's not fun. It's not joyful. I mean, it just helps relieve the pain. But it's not like a joyful, you know, it's not like, you know, you sit on the beach and you have your drink and you, you know. I mean, come on, it's just you get stuck and then you got to figure out, you know, you got to go back to the library.
Well, maybe that explains why you write a book about every 7 years. Because the next book was, hang on, Miracle at Santa Ana, 2002, 7 years later. It took you 7 years.
Well,
to be honest, what were you doing for 7 years?
To be honest, I ghost wrote a book for Quincy Jones. It took about three.
So in 2002, you published a book called The Miracle at Santa Ana. It's based on a true story that you heard somewhere about some black soldiers in World War II who are stranded in this beautiful little town in Tuscany in Italy.
Right.
True story, right?
Based on a true story.
Okay, let me ask you this. I don't understand this about historical novels. A novel is fiction, okay?
Right.
And history's not.
Right.
How can you adopt something that happened in the past and take it and fictionalize it as your own and stay true to it?
That's a good question. Well, the reason, the right way of thinking about that is not how, the question is why. The reason why I did it was because every time I tried to figure out a way to write a book that people would read about black history, I figure as soon as they see black history, they're going to just go reach for, you know, they're going right into the comedy section and, you know, to the other book that says, you know, who stole my cheese, whatever it's called. So I wanted to write a book that would sort of change the mythology, or at least challenge the mythology of the white World War II veteran.
Did you go there and research it?
Oh, yeah, I lived there. I lived there for
long stretches of time in Tuscany?
Yeah, I stayed in the Bogliasco Foundation, which was a foundation that helps writers and artists. I lived there for about maybe almost 6 months total. Spent a lot of time in Florence. I walked a lot of the earth that the black soldiers and the Italian partisans and the Germans and Austrians walked. And I spent a lot of time there because I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, there was a paddle here, and then you walk there and there's the equivalent of like an Italian 7-Eleven. You know, you have to figure out what went on. And so I interviewed lots of Italians. And really, what I learned was that war is the same everywhere.
You said you didn't know what you were doing. I've written one nonfiction book about a wrongful conviction called The Innocent Man that I published in 2006. And I wrote the story because I read the obituary of the guy who almost was executed in Oklahoma. And I loved this story so much. I said, I've got to write this story. And then once I got there to the story, to Oklahoma, and had to start digging, I had no idea what I was doing.
Well, I'm surprised to hear
that. I'm
not
doing that again.
Well, I'm surprised to hear that because your knowledge of legality and the legal frame, you know, and how people march within the framework of the legal world, and it seems to be so sophisticated. I'm surprised to hear that. I mean, I guess it just shows you that we're like ventriloquists. As long as people don't see our lips move, it's all right.
Yeah. You know? Well, yes.
I mean, I feel the same way you feel about nonfiction. It can send you into legal fees that will cost you many thousands. And you know what they do when people sue you? They sue you until you run out of money.
Yeah.
They just keep suing you. That's their way of punishing you. So you have to be careful with nonfiction.
Well, I got sued four times over The Innocent Man. They lined up after that.
Well, here's the problem.
It took a year to get rid of it, but it's not pleasant to go through.
Well, here's the problem that I have, and that that you obviously have as well, is that people think when you walk into the room that you're the big dog, and so you just become a target. And then it makes you say, you don't know who to trust because you're so... Our job is to listen to people. Our job is to sort of listen to what people are saying and to be involved with people. And then when people treat you like you're a suction cup that... You know, like, you're the big guy. It's a terrible place to be. I hated doing that James Brown book. That was just a
big mistake. All right, let's get off the lawyers.
All right.
Something far more pleasant. Movies. How did you get Spike Lee involved in the movie?
You'll find out in about a minute. This is the John Grisham Writers Hour featuring James McBride Up next, McBride learns about all of the awards that John Grisham has won.
I never paid attention to awards. I never got an award.
So well, at least you've got one. Okay?
I mean, you come on. You gotta be kidding. You gotta be kidding.
No.
You're listening to the John Grisham Writers Hour, produced by WMRA and James Madison University from October 2018. Let's pick up the conversation with John Grisham asking James McBride this.
How did you get Spike Lee involved in the movie?
He just called me on the phone one day. He just called me up. I was driving down the street, minding my own business, and I picked up the phone and it was Spike Lee, and he said, hey, James McBride, said, this is Spike Lee, and I love that book. And I thought he was talking about The Color of Water, because I've gotten many offers to do a movie about it. I've always declined. And I said, which book? And he said, The, and I was waiting here, The Color, he said, The Miracle at St. Anna. I was like, oh, wow. So he said, let's meet about it. So we met. And then he wanted to do a handshake agreement in terms of, he said, you want to write the script? I said, I'll take a whack at it. But we didn't really come to an agreement for a year. And I'll tell you why, because he wanted to do a handshake agreement. And
I've never heard of that in Hollywood.
Well, I have, and I did it with Spike Lee, and it worked out great.
How does it work?
Well, you know, you say, I'm going to do it. He says, I'll raise the money. You write the script, I'll raise the money, and we get paid at the end, and that's how it works.
That'll never work with me.
Well,
I'd get sued 5 times.
Yeah. It was just one of those things.
My movie contracts are that thick. It takes the lawyers a year to, you know.
Your books are eminently filmable, and it's, you know, and as soon as your name is attached to something, it has a great monetary value in Hollywood, which brings the lawyers and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's a different level of success and different level of name recognition.
Were you pleased with the movie?
Yeah, I thought he did a great job.
Isn't it fun? I mean, when the Firm came out in 25 years ago, the movie, I had nothing to do with it. In fact, they wouldn't hardly let us go to the set for some reason. And the first time we saw it was the worst place in the world. It was a big, fancy black tie fundraiser in New York City, sitting there, you know, with a bunch of 5,000 of our closest friends. Yeah. We didn't know anybody there. And we're two kids from Mississippi. We're delighted to be there, but also very, very nervous because we haven't seen the movie yet, okay? And we watched The Firm. And, you know, it was fun to watch. It had some problems. I didn't say anything about it. But the sheer excitement of seeing it kind of overwhelmed some of the problems with the movie. That's always been my case with the movies. I enjoy watching them. I don't get hung up with things they may have done wrong.
Yeah, neither do I. You know, once the director has to put their imprint on it,
yeah.
And it's their, you know, they have the creative control. And if they're decent people, they'll get the main story across. It's not, you know, it's not the end of the world if they don't. If your characters aren't exactly as you dream them up.
Yeah. Back in the early days, again, this is probably 25 years ago. I got a phone call one time from Stephen King, and we were talking about movies. He's had every experience in the world with film, from winning the Oscar with Kathy Bates in Misery to suing to try to stop a movie. He's done everything. And he said, look, when it comes to Hollywood, there are two groups of writers. There are those who don't deal with Hollywood for whatever reason. That's a very small group. The second group consists of those of us who do. And if you're in the second group, there are a couple of basic rules. Get all your money up front, kiss it goodbye, and expect it to be something different. Mm. If you don't like that, go join the first group. And I've always remembered that. So, you know, people say, oh, God, they really screwed up such and such a movie. And I just laugh and say, you know, I don't care. I enjoyed watching it.
Yeah, I think that's a healthy
I enjoyed the money, too. You
know? Well, it helps, too, yeah.
Hey, we got to move right along. Hang on.
All right.
We're running out of time here. So, moving right along to your rather slim bibliography. Song next song. This is a Slave Rebellion on the Eastern Shore of Maryland that you published in 2008, only 6 years after your previous book. Another historical novel about a young slave girl named Liz. She escapes. She gets the Underground Railroad. It's really a beautiful story.
Well, it wasn't a commercial success. What I really wanted to do was write about Abraham Lincoln, but I just didn't feel qualified. It was just too hard. And Carl Sandburg had done it so well. What am I going to do it for? So I ended up wandering out on the Eastern Shore, and I still feel that the Underground Railroad is There's so many stories there. So good. So many. They're not just the, you know, daddy's got a secret in the barnyard type of story either, but, you know, about the relationship between people during that time.
So this is 2007. Are you still touring a lot, or are you? I'm trying to figure out what takes you so long.
Well, that's a good question.
If you're on the road, I get it. Okay, if you're earning a buck, you know, playing music, I get that. But
my marriage was falling apart. That
okay,
was
one
business.
That's it right there. That's good. let's don't go into personal thing. And then 5 years later, you picked up the pace, and we have the Good Lord Bird. This is a beautifully written book, like all your books, okay? But this one is wonderfully funny. It was described as a tragicomedy. It's a story of a runaway or freed slave in Kansas back during the border wars, and the slave takes up with John Brown and shows up at Harper's Ferry in 1859 when he's trying to steal a bunch of rifles and cannons to give to freed slaves to start the insurrection. And your character's there, and Liz's nickname is Onion.
Right.
Where'd all this come from?
I don't know. I wanted to write it in the voice of a girl, but I didn't think I could pull it off. So it seemed to me it would be funny if it was a boy pretending to be a girl. And to really just make the caricature of John Brown, who people thought was crazy, just stretch him out and make him funny. Because he was religious, and you know religious things are so, they're just funny. They're just ripe for caricature anyway. So it was an easy stretch. And I don't like these kinds of books where you have to, like, you know, take your medicine, you know. I mean, you know, just, you know, race. I don't really like those kinds of books. I never, you know, they don't do it for me.
Do you ever worry about overdoing the comedy? I mean, some of this stuff is really funny. Some of your one-liners in very serious situations, suddenly the reader gets rocked with a, you know.
Well, you know, the Frederick Douglass... You know, there's a parody of Frederick Douglass now. I'm taking some heat for that, you know. No, I don't feel bad about it because I don't care. I mean, I just don't feel bad about it. I mean, I'm trying to get people to think, and, you know, if you can get them to the mainland, you got to get them across the lily pads on the pond. How do you can get them over? Get them there, you know.
You won the National Book Award.
Well, that was a surprise, you know.
You were sitting there that night, and I've been to that ceremony, by the way, not because my book was nominated, but I had to pay for a table. It's the only way I got in. But the favorites are George Saunders, Thomas Pynchon, a few others, and you're not supposed to win. And you were so unprepared to win that you did not even write a speech.
No, well, you know.
What happened?
I still don't know, you know. It was just one of those things where... I don't know what happened. It was a great moment for me, but I was quite unprepared for it. And sometimes God just drops a lemon drop in the room and says, guess what? And that's really what happened, because it catapulted me into this sort of literary prominence that I really, in a lot of ways, I'm not sure I earned. It's different if you write, and look, if a person writes 30 books, or how many books you've written?
40.
Sorry. I guess I set myself up for that one. You know, there's something about the commercial success of a person. This is the same in music. You know, Michael Jackson was just a big commercial artist during his lifetime. His songs were pop music, and now they've become classics. And you and Stephen as well, and I've had this conversation with Stephen. There's, at a certain point, people start saying, oh, well, you know, what's really good? Just because a book doesn't bore you to tears doesn't mean it has to be a great book. You know what I mean? There's what's a great book and who are the people doing this? So I really didn't pay, I never paid attention to awards. I never got an award. This was the first one I got. And if it's the last one, I've been blessed so much that I'd have to give God back change right now if he took me home. So
at least you've got one, okay?
Well, what it means is I'll always... You mean, you come on. You got to be kidding me. You got to be kidding me.
No, I get the kind of awards that they'll give you the award if you go pick it up. And, you know, the Montana Crime Writers Convention, they'll give you an award if you'll go and make a speech and all that. So I get those kind of, I'm not complaining. I get, you know, I'm rewarded in other ways. Okay, we got a few more minutes. A couple of last questions here. You really toured with Michael Jackson?
Well, I toured, I was writing for People magazine, so I toured him as a reporter.
Okay.
Covering the Michael Jackson for 6 months during his victory tour.
What year was that?
1984.
84.
Yeah, that's when he was really big.
Billie Jean was out.
Yeah, that was the tour. And I saw quite a bit of him at that time. I knew his mother and his brothers, you know. They didn't like me that much because I was a reporter, see. And
were you writing bad stuff about Michael?
No, but I wasn't one of those writers who wrote, like, you know, good stuff either. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't, it was just, it was kind of a job that just fell in my lap. People magazine hired me. I wrote a story about the Beatles for Rolling Stone. It was a cover story. And they saw it and they went, who's this guy James McBride? And they hired me, and like in a month later I was on a plane going to LA to cover Michael Jackson. I had never even been to LA before. And so I ended up staying there and just touring with him for 6 months. So I'm doing like what was the big, I mean, Don King, Al Sharpton, they were all on this tour. It was pitiful. I mean, Michael was a very nice guy. I really liked him. You know, he's tall. He was a tall person, and he was a very decent man. I never really felt he did those things they accused him of doing with kids. I didn't think that it was ever true.
Scatter shooting here. Would you rather write novels or write songs?
I'd rather write novels. Are too hard. I'd rather write songs. But right now, it looks like novels is what's happening. Novels are just, you know. Well, you know, the thing about music is that when you write a song now, what are you writing for? You know, I'm 61. I mean, I can't write that kind of bubblegum pop they're doing now. I don't like it. You know, I can't write for Lil Wayne and other people. You know, I don't even like this, a lot of this bullshit crap that they, you know, I don't like it. I mean, really, I mean, some of the great ones, you know, if you can't
whistle. You can curse, just don't slander anybody. Okay?
Well, I mean, I'm trying to stay out of court again. Yeah, I mean, if you know, I was listening to Conway Twitty yesterday, and Conway Twitty was super. I mean, it was wonderful. That's my job. That's what I do. Everything I do is because of you, to keep you here with me. That's my job. You see, beautiful song about fatherhood. I mean, you know, I don't care if he's more. He was a great song. I mean, the great songwriters are. It feels like they're gone. You know, Sonny Rollins, the great jazz, these people, they're not around anymore. So I don't know who to join. I don't know whose band to join. So I just keep typing away at my novels, I guess.
Well, speaking of that, what are you working on now?
I just finished a novel about an old deacon in Brooklyn who pulls out his heater and shoots the worst drug dealer in the projects. It's another comedy. It's supposed to be funny, you know. About a guy who gets soused, you know.
It sounds hilarious. You're right. I'm cracking up already. That's the opening scene. This old guy kills the biggest drug dealer in Brooklyn.
Well, yeah, but it's, you know.
1969.
Yeah, 1969. It covers old New York, you know, Mayor Lindsay. And it's really about the neighborhood, when Brooklyn was Brooklyn. You know, Brooklyn is different.
You're still there?
Well, I love it. I mean, I'm still, my mother's church still exists. I run a small music program there for kids from the projects, and I'm there every weekend. So, yeah, I still love it, but it's not the same as it was. But everything changes, and but this book is about Brooklyn as I remember it, and when it was just fun and inexpensive, and people of different races and ethnicities got along because they had to get along. I just turned it in. I'm waiting for the edit back from the
publishing. So you published last year, 2017,
yeah.
And this book will come out next year.
Well, you know,
that's a two-year gap for you.
That's right. I'm trying to get like you, just get fast.
Okay, we started with your mom. Let's end with your mom. She died in 2010 at the age of 90?
88.
88, okay. She was born in Poland, right?
Right, yeah.
Buried in Brooklyn?
Buried in High Point, North Carolina, next to her first husband.
To her first husband. Next to
her. My mother's buried in she's the only black person in that cemetery.
Only white person.
Only white
person,
sorry.
Confused, black and white.
It's all, you know, it's just, yeah. She broke the color line again. Well, no, what happened was, That cemetery was all black cemetery. But when my father died, his mother bought four plots. And so my grandparents and my father and my mother were buried there.
And those were her wishes?
Well, you know, she didn't care where she was buried, but I noted that she, you know, her first husband, she used to say that was just my first true love. Yeah. And so I thought it would be approved. And also, the guy who ran the cemetery, he was a young guy when I started writing The Color of Water. He was a young guy on a motorcycle with long hair and all this stuff. And when I went to first see the cemetery, I was researching the book. Then later, when she died, he was still there, and he still remembered me. And I said, my mother just died. He said, I'm going to go sound the cemetery. And he went out there, and he sounded it, I guess, with a pole or whatever. And I finally got out, and I saw him. We were both older. And it was a beautiful moment, you know. And he made it happen, so.
So she left 11 kids.
Left 11 kids, yeah.
How many grandkids?
Oh, at least maybe easily 25, I guess. Yeah, it was a crowd.
Big funeral.
A lot of family at the funeral.
For a beautiful lady.
It was a beautiful, you know, I still think about my mother now, you know, and I think that when I see a mother in the street with her kids, or, you know, I see a little old Jewish lady fighting over the, arguing about the cost of an orange, I think about my mother. I say, give it a damn orange. I'll pay for it myself.
Thank you. Thanks for coming to Virginia.
Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the John Grisham Writers Hour, produced by WMRA and James Madison University's College of Arts and Letters. Special thanks to John Grisham and James McBride, along with JMU Creative Writing Professor Inman Majors. WMRA's Executive Director is Matt Bingay, and I'm Chris Boros. If you missed any of the interview, it's archived at WMRA.org.